Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 27th, 2005. Today's session, Reverence for Prophets, Jesus and Muhammad, presented by Nellie Van Dorn Harder in the Creekside Room, disc number VAN-2005-03. Let's listen in.
We talked. Oh, thank you.
Whoa.
There is light all of a sudden. Oh, we need some more red.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
That helps. Wow.
Looks like the same size almost.
You don't think that's
there's
a random
a space
occurrence.
Here for those of us who need
right.
A chair. There's random. Still a space here in a chair. Yeah? And I don't know, are there other spaces left still? What's the program today? Is it dinner at 5 and 6 or is it
it's dinner? Well, I know dinner is at 5 and Richard Trace is at 7.
Is tonight you're doing a service?
No, I'm just printing.
Oh, you're what?
I'm just printing.
Oh.
I spent all morning making it 6 to 8 minutes only. cutting. Yeah. Okay. Today I wanted to call Who May Speak for God? Because we were going to talk about prophets. And so, you know, in a way, that is the big issue that we are facing. But let us go back to yesterday for a little bit. I really put some people in distress by telling you how the system works. And did we all gather? You need a chair?
I'm just going to sit on the floor.
Are you sure? Are you okay there?
No, yeah? You sit here.
We'll find some more chairs.
Yeah?
Sit here.
Yeah.
Sit here.
There's more chairs out there in the hallway.
Okay. Oh, well, we better wait just a few more minutes. There's more people coming in. Oh, the group from Stehekin is back. Or what do you call this place? Welcome. That's wonderful.
Oh, that gets, I don't know. It gets hard on your back.
We'll put it right back. Yeah. So everybody sitting comfortably? That door?
Do not walk.
Oh dear.
The flies will come in.
I'll be okay, you think?
Yes.
Well, if we all fall asleep, we just take a mass nap and then wake up. Go on again, a power nap of 3 minutes. Why not? Yeah, we're not starting yet, Antonio. Okay, shall we kind of start?
Mm-hmm.
So yesterday we talked about the system, right? And let me write down for you again. There is, if I say Q is Quran, you understand that, or should I write it out?
Mm-hmm.
H is Hadith or tradition. Then there is the interpretation, and then you have the famous Sharia. We've heard about that, right?
No.
Sharia. Oh, we'll come back to that. Don't worry. Sharia, the Islamic law. So just to recover what we were talking about yesterday, we learned, and this is important to understand if we talk about Islam, we have lots of modes of being a Muslim. You have African Muslims, right? You have Muslims in Asia. You have Muslims in Southeast Asia. They all have different customs, habits, but they all take their original text from what was made or what was shaped in the Middle East. And that's very important to keep in mind, right? In the 7th, 8th, 9th century, until about the 13th century, when the empire, remember we talked about that yesterday, when the empire more or less was fell apart, and different areas of the Islamic world came into existence. And what is exciting for us now is that we now also have Islam in America, Islam in Canada, Islam in many European countries. And so I think we will not see it in our lifetime, but one day there will be a Dutch Islam, and there will be a German Islam. I don't know what that will look like. That will be very, sorry, who of you is German from background? Because I'm Dutch, we like to joke about Germans. Because they occupied us for 5 years. Anyway. So don't forget that. We are in a very exciting time where those new interpretations are being shaped, but they all go back to that original body. And that is where our problems come from. Because, of course, what you have is a struggle. A struggle of people say, oh my gosh, Islam is going to disintegrate. It's going to become like Christianity. If you do not go back to the same body, you know, then you get what we have, all these denominations and all these groups and all these interpretations. But that is actually something that is starting in the Muslim world, this breaking up of the system that was held together first till the 13th century and then till the beginning of the 20th century, and then with the colonialism and new modes of new types of science and learning coming in, they had to think of something else. Do we all remember that from yesterday? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Okay. Then the video, wherever they are, can start rolling now. And we're going to Who May Speak for God. And there were two questions, by the way, before I start with with telling you an anecdote. There were two questions. The first one was, can we talk a little bit about suicide bombers? Mm-hmm. Now, that is on the program for Friday. Twice, 7:30, and I don't know when the next session is, sorry. And I never really do exactly the same thing, so is that okay with everybody? Or is there anybody who says, oh my gosh, I'll be gone, then I will miss that. So Friday, that is where, you know, it's not just a suicide bomber, but the whole jihad issue. That is what we're going to discuss Friday. So if you don't mind, we're leaving that for today. Then someone else asked me, and I wonder how many of us think the same question. Why should we still be Christians? Is there any other person here who thinks that, who says, wow, I get so much information on all kinds of levels, and there's so much new age stuff going on, and so much doubt in this world? Is anybody else here saying, that is a question that is really in my heart, that I struggle with that question? Why should I be a Christian? Yeah? Who, raise your hands. Some of you have that question, okay. Because I don't know when it will fit, but I'd like to try to come back to it. And if we can't, maybe those of us who are interested in that question could have a little group at one point and sit together over coffee, preferably, and discuss it. So now we go back, unless there are any questions about yesterday, I'll go to the next step. Are there any questions or remarks about yesterday? Okay, yeah?
Well, I had one question yesterday. Can you give us an idea of what's in these bombers' heads
right. Before
they strap all that stuff on?
Right, and is it okay when we do that Friday?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, okay, because then we can talk about most of that. Yeah? Okay. Let me start with the Quran. We all know that the Quran is written in Arabic, and that you are not allowed to translate it. If you have translations, it is never called a translation, it is called an interpretation or a rendition. So at one point, a Lebanese Christian was caught, I think, for stealing in New York and put in jail. And there he shared, I don't know how the jails work here, but he shared some space with African Americans who had become Muslim and learned that he knew Arabic. And he said, oh, you're a Muslim, you know Arabic, teach us the Quran. So he spent the rest of his time usefully teaching them Arabic and the Quran. They just assumed that he was a Muslim. And so everybody who knows Arabic is assumed to be a Muslim, because Islam was revealed in Arabic the most beautiful of languages to the Muslims. So everybody forgets, even Muslims forget, that there are lots of Christians living in Muslim lands. And so the language of the Quran is so powerful that that by itself can make him a Muslim. Who of us knows Arabic? Not yet? Okay? I just want to say beware if you do study it, because that is the assumption, that when you learn it and then you start to read the Quran, automatically you will be drawn to it. And if you read the first conversion stories, that's how they went. One of the most avid raiders or conquerors of Islam, he once passed by the hut of the Prophet Muhammad and heard him recite a verse and was so impressed that his heart immediately turned and he accepted Islam. And before that he was a polytheist. So that is the power of the language. And we don't recognize that, do we? Because we are all after Reformation people who can read our Bible in whatever language we want. But that also means something else. It means that those of us who become Muslim and cannot read the Arabic and do not understand the Arabic will still recite everything in Arabic. And that by itself is powerful enough to affect your state of mind, your state of health, your everything. So in a way, the Quran is also considered a book of magic. It's a book that just by itself gives power. So now you understand why you go on a plane ride and you have a Muslim sitting next to you who happens to have a Quran in his carry-on. That carry-on will never go on the floor. Whatever happens, there will be made a space in the overhead compartment, because the Quran cannot be on the floor. That is demeaning it. And that is, you know, ignoring its power. So, if the language is so powerful, what can you do with it? Well, friends of mine in Indonesia, who are activists and working on women's rights, and of course with no money, their eye fell on a house. They said, we need an office. And so they found a house that they really wanted, but they had no money. And so the first thing they did is that they sat in front of the house all night reciting certain parts of the Quran, all night, repeating over and over again what they considered the most powerful verses of the Quran. And of course, then I would know, I kept phoning them, like, did you get it? No, not yet. But then they got another house, and to them that was really the result of the reciting of the whole through the night. So you see, it is just the language, just the words are so powerful. And if you, has any of you bought a Faridisa book? Did you probably get the last copy? I saw there were not very many, but if you buy it at home, you will see that he also gives some of the stories, and they are real life stories. Like some people, you know, they don't know any Arabic. All they can say is that, recite the Quran, quick, we're in danger. Okay, then they just say, Aleph, Ba, Ta, the Arabic letters, enough, you know? That by itself is powerful enough. So you see why the Quran is so important. Remember yesterday we said it's considered the holy word of God. You cannot change one letter. So it is so important that Muslims will never tolerate criticism on the Quran, will never step away from what's in the Quran. And we had yesterday, we had that with the question about polygamy, remember, that I told you, you cannot delete those verses, you cannot ignore them, you somehow have to deal with them in real life. So that is one of the problems that Muslims face, and indirectly that we face. Because, you know, Muslims who want to connect with Christians, they will always have to ask someone who has interpreted the Quran, and then if they come to someone who reads certain verses, because remember yesterday we also said there's different layers of verses in the Quran about Christians that range from total acceptance, great admiration, to stay away from them. Remember? Yesterday we talked about that. So that is one of the problems that really is an Islamic problem. It's not our problem. It is their problem that they have to break through somehow and reinterpret their scriptures. and be able to step away from certain texts and say, well, these texts obviously are no longer valid today. We now have to look at other texts. And that is something that is starting. And again, it is starting here, because Muslims here are back to the time when the environment is not Islamic. It is mostly Christian, right? And so they are forced to think about the other. So you have two reactions. And that leads us a little bit to your suicide bombers. Two reactions. One reaction is mixing. One reaction is, yes, we have to live with others. We should learn about them. We should study with them. And we should be part of them, of their community. The other reaction is withdrawal. So these two reactions. So have you ever heard or seen Muslim communities who completely withdraw and insist and have long debates whether or not the children can go to the prom? Have you heard about those debates? Whether or not the children can go to birthdays? You know, those that is a big issue right now. So these two, and so we see this battle going on within those communities. And as I say, it is something that those communities have to come to terms with. But if you are aware of it, if you run into anybody who belongs to either of the two, that will give you a heads up in how to talk with people, right? And how to give them space, and how to, you could ask them questions, you can discuss things with them, and so forth and so forth. So that is about the Quran. Before I go on, are there, and there's also long debates that, as far as I know, are no longer current in Christianity. What to do with old Qurans? What to do with copies, photocopies of the Quran? Have you ever thought about that? That's a huge issue. You cannot throw out a photocopy of the Quran just like that, because it's holy word. So what I always do is shred them or burn them, because I don't want any of my Muslim students potentially to see and say, oh, she's a heretic, she threw away, and you know, what if it falls on the floor and I step on it? That is potentially dangerous. That has led in some countries to interreligious riots, where someone was accused, a Christian was accused, of degrading the Quran by stepping on it. For example, because it, through the wind, it fell on the floor, a paper. Because in a lot of countries, by the way, you might not be aware of that, but places like Indonesia, not everybody has money for a whole Quran. So some people just have a little pile of photocopies. And that's what they read, with the most important verses. So those, I don't know, maybe Dorothy, are there any similar discussions and debates about Bibles?
Orthodox Jews give Torah scrolls.
Right.
And a special bearer.
Right. Right. Yeah, it looks like Orthodox Judaism. Right.
And there is a certain sense, I think, that the words themselves are, in certain forms of Kabbalism,
right,
the words themselves have the same kind of natural.
Right, right, absolutely.
And I think, although we don't have any rules about it, I would have a hard time throwing the Bible into the garbage.
Me too.
I think we have a feeling that would be appropriate.
Right, right. We feel, we have a sense you can do that. However, we don't discuss it at great length in big, thick magazines, and we don't write books about it. So that is... Just that you, do I give you a sense of what the Quran means for a Muslim? Yeah? So now, when you talk about, so it's the direct word of God, and it is very sacred, and that brings us to something else, the purity. The purity. There's always this fear that there will be pollution. Pollution by the wrong people touching it. For example, a woman who is menstruating is not allowed to touch it. Same in Orthodox Judaism with the Torah, right? You are not allowed to touch it in an impure state. So that is why whenever you start reciting the Quran or when you touch it, you have to do the ablution. And you have to say a small prayer to be ritually clean to touch that holy book. So that means what? That means what? That if you have this text that you wanna, that you consider as holy and you want to keep it pure, again, nobody can touch it. You see? Nobody can touch it. And if you are a Christian and you recite it that is very offensive to a Muslim if they happen to know you're a Christian. And that's why I say they assume you're Muslim. Right? So that is about the Quran. Now, there's one thing, by the way, I have to tell you that I forgot to say yesterday, going back, not to the Quran, just going back to the C, one of the C words, remember in all these C words, the C word of culture. I think I forgot to mention that, but it comes in here. It comes in here. The C word of culture, at the time that Islam developed, the Prophet Muhammad was a tribal Arab. He was someone who had grown up in a tribe, although his tribe had settled in the city of Mecca, but he had grown up in a tribe. Tribes are like the United States of America. Fiercely independent, they call their own shops, have their own rules, and don't you mix with us. That's a tribe in Arabia. And that is, in a way, the model that was taken over by Islam. Because what happened was, he was a brilliant strategist. He made peace with all the tribes in Arabia. And so what he basically built was one big super tribe called Muslims. And those tribes in the old days, before Islam came, used to fight against each other. Who knows about that? They used to fight each other all the time. So now they no longer could fight. And hence, the extra energy to go out. You see, I told you they did what the Prophet would have done. They went out to the northern side of what is now Saudi Arabia and on to what is now Jordan and so forth. But there was also, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not insulting anybody, an overdose of hormones there. They had to, you know, they could no longer fight against each other. And they were used to that. So they had to go out, and you see? But there was this extra energy, but it was also the whole culture. They took the Arabic culture with them. Now, coming back again to Saudi Arabia, I told you about the Arab World League, right? That was set up in the 60s, didn't I? Okay, the whole idea behind that, let's say the Arab World League, isn't that a type of pop, a soft drink? Okay. Anyway, Arab World League. What they want is their interpretation, their system, to spread out all over the Arabic world. And there again, we have the suicide bomber problem. All over the Arabic world, and all over the Muslim world. Now, that is heavily tainted by culture. Why is that? Because the second layer, and here we get to the Prophet, the second layer of where a Muslim will seek information is the tradition, called the Hadith. In the tradition is everything the Prophet Muhammad did and said. That is why in Indonesia there are very, very conservative Muslims who will not ride a bike, because the Prophet Muhammad never rode a bike. And that is why there are Muslims who will never eat melon, because he is not known to have eaten melon. So, and that is why Muslims in Indonesia eat dates with, for example, the fasting time, because, you know, dates are plenty in the Middle East, and you don't have them in a place like Indonesia, and they hate them. They can't stand them. They're way too sweet for them, but they eat them because the Prophet Muhammad ate them. So everything he did and said is in a tradition, and it is the second layer of where you get your information and your guidance as a Muslim. Who knew about that? Not yet? So this is important. But why? Because not everything is in the Quran. Right? So what people started to do was gather all the stories. After he died, they started to gather all the stories, what he had said and done. And there, especially where he had acted a little bit like Moses. When people had a quarrel, he was like a judge between them. When people had economic problems, he gave an advice. And what would he do? For example, there is a famous tradition about a Jewish couple that was found committing adultery. And the question was what to do with them. And he said, what does it say in their Torah? And well, you know what it says in the Torah, don't you? You all know that, right? Who doesn't know? What? Stone, right. Stone. And then he said, stone both. So that became the precedent then for how to treat if a group of non-Muslims is taken to you with a special problem, you look in their own scriptures and you see what to do with them. And if it is not in their own scriptures, you see what Islam teaches. So in the tradition are lots of things. However, these traditions were gathered many years after the death of the Prophet. They started to be gathered after people became aware that they had to build a system, right? And that the Quran by itself was not enough. So imagine we're sitting here in Holden saying all kinds of wise things, wearing blue and white t-shirts, and 100 years after this event, someone comes in Holden and says, well, what did these people do exactly, and writes it down. How do you think these stories will be transmitted? Can you imagine? Lots of nonsense, right? Well, that happened. Well, over 600,000 traditions were gathered. They were scrutinized. About 9,000 made it. And of those, nowadays, more and more scholars of Islam, Muslim scholars of Islam, find that at least half of those is false, not true. I'll give you an example of another tradition. And my favorites are the one on the women, because they are so in the tribal Arabic atmosphere, and they do not fit in today's world, but they also don't fit in Islam in Indonesia or Islam in America. For example, according to Islam, a woman always has to serve her husband in the bed. Whether she is, but how the Quran doesn't say. So the tradition continues with that, whether she's tired or whether she's sick or whether she's sitting on a camel. She has to be prepared to receive her husband. There are no camels in Indonesia. So, you see, the thing is that for hundreds of years, students all over the Muslim world learned those traditions that absolutely did not fit their real life. But they accepted them. Why? Because the Prophet had said it. And because the Prophet had said it, they were considered sacred. Sacred. And that is what if we talk about prophets, you see, and we look at the level of the Prophet Muhammad, we see that the Quran is very sacred, but that he and everything he said and did has gained almost the same level of sacredness. And that is a huge problem today for Muslims, because they read those traditions and say, this is baloney. But you can't say that out loud, and you can't say, just delete it, take it out of the text, you see, because it is considered sacred. And again, it is so infused with Arab culture that it doesn't fit in many places. Another one of the traditions is, which is about, the Quran says that a man and a wife, and that is actually a very beautiful verse, should be like each other's blankets. Which means you should protect each other, keep each other warm, and what is in the family should stay in the family. Well, in a tradition that has been elaborated as that a woman can never steal from her husband. A woman who steals from her husband is worse than 70,000 thieves. So, my friends in Indonesia write, I'd rather rob a bank than I'm just one thief. And, you know, why am I, if I steal $10 from my husband, why am I worse off than 70,000 thieves and get the punishment of 70,000 thieves? So you see, the tradition was, according to Muslims, directly taken from the Prophet Muhammad, but in reality it was shaped by those gathering them, and in it came a lot of things from the culture. And I'm very unfortunate, I'm unhappy to say so, a lot is anti-women. So if you hear about Islam and, you know, that it is so, you know, kind of, how can I say it, huh? Misogynist, yeah, that's the best word, really. That is not just from the Quran, that is mostly from the tradition. That is 7th century Arab culture, right? So that is one other layer. Now then we have the layer of interpretation, and together, and as I told you, that was very much from again the villages from the Arab world, and later on a lot of the interpreters were converted Jews, converted Christians, and based on that in the earliest century was the famous Islamic law. And if I say Islamic law, Sharia, what do you know about it? What do you think about when I say Islamic law?
Taliban.
What?
Taliban,
right?
And if you're a thief, you lose a hand.
You lose a hand, your hand will be cut off. Stoning of women, right. That is, and you see, that all goes back to the tribal law of the 7th century. And that, again, so, but the problem is, since the Islamic law is based on the Quran, is based on the tradition, and then on the interpretation of people who are now considered semi-holy, you cannot get out of it. You, again, when people say, we want to apply the Sharia, they feel they apply the direct law of God, and you have to apply the whole thing, including the stoning, the hacking off of hands, and that is very scary, especially for minorities. That is very scary for moderate Muslims, progressive Muslims, average Muslims, and it is very scary for minorities. Because who in the 21st century wants that kind of punishment? Right? But then also, well, we have to keep in mind, there's one other thing that we have to keep in mind when we talk about this whole project, that Muslims do choose. For example, slavery is in the Quran too. There is no official slavery any longer in the Muslim world. There's, of course, lots of unofficial slavery. Let me not start about that. You know, if you think about Saudi Arabia, guest workers, and so forth, that's unofficial slavery very often. But, so in a way, you know, on the one hand, Muslims say, we cannot change this. But on the other hand, they do. You see, because it is the 21st century. People do develop new thoughts, like all of us have changed. Muslims change too, and they're not crazy. You see? So in a way, when I say it is problematic for Muslims what to do with their scriptures, what to do with their tradition, you understand the battle that's going on. And I can very much imagine that it is similar to the time of the Reformation, because people ask, you know, why does Islam not have a Reformation? Well, neither had the Orthodox Christians in the Middle East. They had no Reformation either. You know, the Enlightenment and the whole the new ways of thinking that we developed in Europe and then brought to America and so forth. Well, right now, the Muslim world is going through a kind of Reformation. And hence again, your suicide bombers. Because they react. That it must be very similar to how the atmosphere was during the Reformation, when people just could not imagine to leave the Latin texts in church, to let priests just be married. Have you ever thought about how the Reformation, how difficult it must have been in those early years, you know? These huge changes. Now we're used to it, but in those days, you know, it was all new for people. And so if we look at Islam, we see right now that same struggle and that same battle. And of course, Muslims would rather bite their tongues and say, we're in the Reformation. But when we look back in 50 years, we might say, yeah, this is what happened. And it is actually very much triggered by people like Bin Laden. Because suddenly people say, well, is that Islam? Can I identify with that as a Muslim? Do I want this in my life? Is this how I believe in God? I mean, all these questions were called up by 9/11. You know, this is not just our reactions, but the Islamic world is in a deep turmoil right now, thinking about how to process this. And maybe you heard about the Pew Research that just came out 3 weeks ago. All of us heard about it. There was so strange. In Europe, it was on every front page. And here, nobody's heard about it. The Pew Foundation, or whatever they called, endowment, had a huge research about attitudes in the Muslim world, or how Muslims saw us. I won't give that. You look up yourself how they see us. But the support for suicide bombers. The question was, do you support suicide bombers? It has dropped dramatically. It has dropped like by 50%, 40-50%. People no longer think that suicide bombing is a good option. So you see, there's a lot going on. But this system, what to do with it? Now, so if I talk about this, you understand the role of the Prophet in Islam, because that's what we were talking about, right? So, who may speak for God? The role of the Prophet. What is a Prophet according to Islam? Prophet, right? My students sometimes write FIT. So I have to watch it myself. Well, if I tell you this, the Prophet Muhammad, how do you think he is being considered by a Muslim? What do you think?
He speaks for God and he's the only true prophet.
He speaks for God and he's the only true prophet. He was the only one who had the revelation. And remember, it's the last revelation, it's the true revelation, and it's the correction of all the other revelations. It corrects it. This is the Quran, and it is actually half Bible, so to speak, half Old, half New Testament. It's the correction of both.
But doesn't, I mean, when you speak to moderate Muslims who I spoke to, a lot of them will recognize Jesus as a valid prophet.
Right, right. And I'll come back to that, because we have time for that, right? Yeah, we do. Because I want to tell you, too, what Muslims think about Jesus. But again, the thing is that, you know, who reads? What do they read? Remember that I said about the Trinity? You know, they don't really care about the Trinity. What they care about is that they learn in hundreds of years to stay away from Christians. That's what matters. So that is the pattern we have to change. Now, so he is the messenger of God. You cannot insult the prophet. For example, a few years ago in Indonesia, there was, a journal had a contest, or is it a contest? They wanted to know who is the most popular person right now, right? And it was a Christian journal, unfortunately. Guess what? Prophet Muhammad, 6th place, Jesus, 7th place. Who was first? Who? Elvis Presley? Almost. Guess more.
Tell me it wasn't Michael Jackson.
Muhammad Ali.
No, they don't know Michael Jackson as well. Madonna! I nearly died. Anyway, guess what? The editor went to prison and spent 7 years in jail for insulting the prophet. This was, you know, he just relayed the results of his survey, or what you call it. And so you see how serious this is. This is not just insulting the prophet, is very serious, because you then insult the vessel of God. And so you understand now why this tradition, with all sometimes nonsense in it, also has to be taken serious. And if you are a Muslim who grew up with learning about the tradition, you take it serious. Okay, so the Prophet Muhammad, first of all, we know what he looked like. We have a description of him, and he seems to have been quite handsome. He seems to have had very strict personal hygiene, and that's why also you have in Islam all these rules about personal hygiene. You know about that, right? So the ablution 5 times a day, and so forth and so forth. He seems to have been kind. He was kind to children, and he was good to his wives. And they say that he was always an honest person, and that he didn't care about riches, and that he fasted a lot. So we have a description about him, and that the people around him reacted very positively to him. They all liked him, he was a well-liked person, even before he had the revelation. So he did, people feel that he had an inspired wisdom, and that's why he could have 9 wives. And not 4 only, although it is in the Quran that you can have only 4. He could have 9 wives because he had the wisdom to deal with them that normal humans lack. He had 4 children, and praise the Lord, they were only girls. You don't want to think about a prophet who had boys, wouldn't you? Mm-hmm. In the Arabic world, no. He had several boys, they all died, and one of the boys, one of the sons he had, only became about 3 years old, was given to him, or what you call it, was the result of his relationship with a Coptic woman, Miriam, Coptic woman. I hate to say this, but she was a gift from the patriarch of Egypt.
Oh.
Yeah, it was a time of slavery, remember? And so he wasn't ever, he, and that's what makes it so difficult for us. He wasn't a house father. He was a husband. He was married the first years of his life, till he was about 50 years old. He was married to a businesswoman, And according to the tradition, she was much older than he was, which I don't believe, because, you know, a woman over 50 having six kids, just you try, right? That doesn't make sense. But that's according to the tradition. To the tradition, she was a lot older than him, and that makes him even better. He accepted that, and so forth. And after she died, he married more women, more than one. So you see, he was a regular human being who died regularly. He didn't go up to heaven. Who spoke with people whom we know a lot about. And that, according to Muslims, is one of the pluses that they have over Christianity. There's something else that we have to say about the Prophet Muhammad. He was successful. What prophet dies on the cross? He's a loser in Islamic, tribal, Arab, Middle Eastern thinking. You don't die on the cross as a prophet. That doesn't make sense. Prophets always win. That's it. Like the tribal chief, he wins. Like Arnold Schwarzenegger, he wins. You see? But you see what the problem is with Christ. We believe he humbled himself up to the cross. And that doesn't make sense to the Arab mind. And that then became, of course, the Muslim tradition. So that's the Prophet Muhammad. In a way, they really elevated him to the same level as the Quran. But of course, they will always say that's not true. But but the big, let's say, chip that they feel, that Muslims feel they hold against our message, is that he was a real person. Now about Jesus. And they asked me to be frugal with making photocopies. So if you want a photocopy of this page, I can gladly make one for you, but let me know. Yeah, who wants a photocopy of this page that describes about Christ in the Quran? Okay, let's see. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, about 15 people. Okay, so we'll make photocopies. Well, because what does it say in the Quran about Christ? That he was born without a father. We know the name of Prophet Muhammad's father and mother. It says he was born without a father. It is described how Mary gave birth to Jesus. It says that Mary was the sister of Moses and Aaron, as in she came from the lineage of Moses and Aaron. And it says without seed, so without a father. That's what it says in the Quran. Well, that should make him miraculous enough, right? And it says, the word of God entered Mary. The word of God entered Mary. And she gave birth to Jesus, a prophet. And in the Quran you find that, because think about this. This is, again, Middle Eastern mindset, okay? Thinking, how did this work? Is Mary, unmarried woman, supposedly should be stoned, remember? Right? Who was pregnant? Can't do that, so big. No. So, she was pregnant. She hid behind the palm tree, if you read it in the Quran, and came out with a baby. And everybody says, how can this be? And Mary said, nothing. And the baby answered. According to the Quran, it was Jesus who defended his mother and said, I am a prophet of God. Well, that did it. Okay? So, you see, it's a very Middle Eastern tale. She had to be protected. And according to the Quran, he also, at a very young age, did miracles. He made clay birds and then blew life into them. And they came alive. So, if you read the story about Jesus up to that point, you say, yeah, he needs lots of respect. He deserves lots of respect, right? The problem is that then he created a community, or after him a community was created called Christians. And remember, they are the other C word, the competition. Remember from yesterday we talked about the competition. So, are these verses picked up regularly from the Quran? No. Muslims, they might know them, they will hardly refer to them. What do they refer to? They refer to the other verses. That is, that Jesus himself was not crucified. Who was crucified? That's unclear. According to the interpretation, Judas was crucified instead of Jesus. It was not Jesus. And hence all these stories. Have you heard about these stories? That Jesus went to India?
Oh,
and lately in that book, what's called again? To France?
Da Vinci's Code.
These stories were enlarged by Islam. Because if he wasn't crucified, where was he? Huh? Have you thought about that? That's a mystery. So someone else was crucified in his place. And he did not die. He did not die. That's another issue of Jesus. He never died. God took him up to heaven unto himself because he loved him. That's in the Quran. God took Jesus. So everything is there apart from the crucifixion. Isn't that something? Everything is there. But here it comes. Then the Quran says, when Jesus ascended into heaven, God asked him, Jesus, did you say, I am Son of God and God? And Jesus answered, be merciful to me, O Lord. You know that I did not say so. Neither shall I boast that I am your servant. But men who have gone astray wrote that I said this thing, and they spoke lies against me, and they are in error. That is taken together from all the verses in the Quran that give bits and pieces about what Jesus allegedly said to God. And God answered to him, I know that you will not say this thing. So this is what is in the Quran about Jesus. And I thought that was very important for you to understand, because now you understand how influential the competition element was. It was not about the message, you see, but it was the competition. You want to shape your own religion. And so you stop looking at your own book here, what does my book say, but you look just at the community. You make it a social issue. You make it an economic issue. You make it a political issue. And it no longer really is a religious issue. You see? So that is why I said in the very first time we met, it is almost useless to sit together and say, what does the Quran say? The Quran says everything you need for a proper dialogue. But it is no longer the Quran that rules here, although it should. Because the interpreters conveniently glossed over those verses. And they also, by the way, have reasoned out who the correct and right Christians were. Do you know who the correct Christians are? Those of us who have accepted the message of the Prophet Muhammad. So all the good Christians were living before the Prophet Muhammad came. Everybody else after him is no good. That is what came into the interpretation. Now, why was this so important, that interpretation? Again, because the Muslims were in an ocean of Christians, remember? And they had rules for that. Who knows that there were special rules for Christians and Jews? And do you know where those rules came from? Okay, from two places. Remember I told you that the Muslim community moved from Mecca to Medina. Remember that? 622. Don't have to remember that. Just remember 7th century. Don't think it was the 18th century or something. 7th century. They had to move from Mecca to Medina because they were persecuted in Mecca. Okay? Now, they came to Medina, and the Prophet Muhammad realized there were polytheists, there were Jews, and there were Muslims. He understood that it would not be politically correct to murder the polytheists. So he made rules. He made rules following the tribal rules how to interact with those who did not belong to the tribe. That was, we will leave you alone as long as you leave us alone, and we will protect you as long as you do not fight against us behind our back. So there was a lot of freedom. This is called the Contract of Medina. Then as the Muslims went out, they put on top of that the Roman rules. Remember the Apostle Paul? Remember him? He was a Roman citizen, so he had to be taken to Rome to be judged. So there was a difference between Romans and non-Romans. Remember? We know that from the Bible. They took those rules And those rules combined, the contract of Medina and the rules from taken from the Romans, became the special rules for Christians and Jews. And then also Zoroastrians and Manichaeans, but those were not that many. Everybody else who was, let's say, a polytheist had to be killed. After the time the Prophet Muhammad was dead and they spread out, everybody else had to be killed. But remember I told you with New York and they had to pay taxes? Remember? So the Christians and the Jews, according to those rules, had to pay taxes. But there were some other parts of the rules. They were not allowed to proselytize, and they were not allowed to build new houses of worship. Well, if you do that to a community, what does that mean? If you say you are no longer allowed to proselytize, you are no longer allowed to carry outside the Lutheran, Methodist, whatever faith you have, and you're no longer allowed to make new houses of worship, what does that mean?
You slowly die.
It's a death sentence. It's a slow death sentence. And the Christians and Muslims and Jews didn't realize that. But it is the slow death sentence. And that is what happened. Remember I told you in the Middle East, it was really demographics that converted the Middle East into marriage and so forth. So you see, when I say the whole issue was taken away from the Quran and became political, because according to the Islamic interpretation of the message of the Prophet Muhammad, Muslims had to rule. Nobody, and this is of course a huge issue for Muslims here. Can you imagine that? Because we don't have exactly a Muslim president. And that's why you have all these discussions among Muslims, for example, to do the same as the Mormons have done. Just go to all to Nevada, or all to, I don't know, which state is fairly available? I have no idea. Montana, maybe?
Washington?
Oh dear, that's Holden Village. Yeah. You don't want that. No, but you know, there are serious discussions on where shall we go that we can at least have our own local government. You see? And there are also sheikhs or imams in the Middle East who say, you are not allowed to live under a non-Muslim government. Of course, they're, you know, you'd say, where are they? What were they thinking? What are you supposed to do when you move to the West, you know? But you see, that is the issue that comes from the position that the Christians and Jews had in the early years. And this position lasted till the 19th century, by the way. Anybody wants to know the Arabic word for it? It's called the dhimmi position. And every caliph, the thing is this, in theory you are protected, but in practice things can happen any minute, and you never know. Every caliph could at will add rules. For example, there was one caliph, he's considered crazy, but he was there and he was the ruler, what can you do? He ordered the Christians to wear very heavy crosses, like crosses that were like 10 pounds or more. And so it was very hard to be a Christian, you see? And the Jews, they had to wear other things. And then they had to wear certain clothes. So think Nazi Germany, remember, with the stars and so forth. You became recognizable as a person of another faith. And that way, people could harass you, or people could demand certain things from you. So in a way, they came in this position that was under the Muslims and never secure. You always look over your shoulder. And only the British, I think it was 1869 when it was abolished, 1869. So it lasted for 1200 years more or less, right? Mm-hmm. That condition, or a little less. But so you see, this is what ruled and set the mindset. And then in Egypt, if you have extremist Muslims, especially young Muslims, they are insulted that there are still Christians. Why are there still 8 million Christians here? They should have gone over to Islam. How stubborn can they be? Right? And then, if you come in the West, there is this feeling among many Muslim communities, like, we should be the ruler, and these people should be under us because they were there for so many years. So you see the dilemma. You see, it's primordial almost. It's psychological. It is not logical. You see? And so that is what all goes in. If we talk about interfaith dialogue, that all comes into it. All these feelings and sentiments and so forth and so forth. Okay, are there any questions? No questions? Yeah.
Kind of about the central authority aspect of all
yeah.
this. You mentioned several hundred thousand traditions, and then there were winnowed down to a few thousand. Who decided then, and is there a parallel authority today?
Yeah. Who decided then, this is the idea of that we Christians had too, I don't know.
What?
We Protestants have lost all sense of hierarchy.
I know, that's what I'm getting.
Veneration for the minds of the apostles and those after them. If you go to the Orthodox Church, they will say that the early fathers and mothers had much more wisdom in interpreting the scripture than we have. We just are too far away from the time of Jesus. So this is the same reasoning. People who were the closest to the time of the Prophet Muhammad, they still could do this. They had the wisdom, they still heard the stories in real life, and they still were able and capable to make those judgments. And that is why you will hear in the Muslim world, I heard many times, there's no more good Muslims. No more good Muslims. They're all died out. So, you see, it is because the good ones were at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, the real good ones. And then a little bit after that, they became worse and worse and worse. And so you now also understand this desire to go back. The desire to return. Return to what? Mm-hmm. Huh? That's unclear. But there is a desire to return. And we don't have that, do we? Who has the desire to return to the dusty day of Jesus? Any of us wants to return?
The fundamentals come close.
What?
The fundamentals sometimes come close.
Yeah, but they still have their laptops and big cars and right? So, I mean, the return would mean what? That is what we're going to talk about Friday. It's so unclear, you know, and nobody knows exactly, but this is where desire comes from. It was pure then. People had pure minds. No C word of corruption, right? Mm. No C word of Christians. No J word of Jews. Others. Pure. Forget about it. There was only, like, I don't know, a couple of thousand souls in Medina, right? Not so many billions. How many billions are we nowadays? It goes so fast, I lose track. What? How many?
Six.
Are we six by now? You know? Yeah, it goes so fast. So you see, it is irrational. It's a dream, but it is based on all I've told you now. I saw another hand. Yeah?
How do these groups like Sunnis and Shiites and Wahhabis fit into all this?
Ooh! Now, Wahhabis will discuss Friday, but you won't be here, right?
No.
Oh dear, oh dear. Well, the Wahhabis were in the 19th century, no, actually 18th century, and they felt that they needed to purify Islam, go back to pure Islam, because they felt Islam had to become too folkloristic, you know, because most people don't know the Quran. Till today, most people don't know the Quran. Most people are more or less, what you call it, a little bit mystical. They know a few prayers and they will recite those prayers. I mean, the fact, like us Protestants, well-educated Protestants and Catholics or whatever we are, reading the Bible is pretty new in history. And it's the same in the Islamic world. A lot of people are still illiterate. So, especially in the 17th century, this Abdul Wahhab felt that people were not really correct in their belief. And he wanted to clear it all up. And he was so ruthless that his brother wrote a book against him. Do you know that? Mm-hmm. There's only one copy in the States. It's in the Princeton Library. Mm-hmm. I've not had a chance to read it yet, but one day I want to. Because he was puritanical. He made people around him sick. But he had a few followers. And those followers, later on, came to be in alliance with the House of Saud. When the House of Saud gained the political power in what is now Saudi Arabia, they were supported by the Wahhabi followers. And that is why we now have Wahhabis all over. Because they could join hands with the political power. Now, going back to the beginning of Islam, groups like that you've had all the time. You have had groups who were discussing who is the real sinner. Can I say in this room who goes to hell or not? And they thought they could, right? There were big debates going on in Islam in the very early years, and some groups would split up and other groups would not. Then there was the debate, who may speak for God? Who should follow the Prophet? Should it be people who are capable, which is Sunnite? The Sunnites say anybody can follow the Prophet as long as this person is capable. Actually, they say anybody can follow the Prophet as long, it could be even a slave. So in a way, it's very democratic. Very democratic way of choosing your ruler. The Shiites said, no. The Prophet had a cousin that he raised as a son. That was Ali. He should be the ruler. And that is the difference between Shiites and Sunnites. That one group says, anybody can rule us. The other group said, no. It has to come from the house of Ali. What was, of course, the bone of contention? Political power and money. Right? Political power and money, nothing else. Because the Sunnites, at one point, had their headquarters in Baghdad, first in Damascus and then in Baghdad, and they were doing really well. You know, they had a rich area, they had a rich empire, and people were studying all kinds of things. There was avid trade, and there come these people saying, no, Ali should be, the descendants of Ali should be in charge. Well, there were no descendants of Ali, as far as they could see, who were capable. Right? And of course they were caliph themselves, so they felt they were the most capable themselves. They didn't want to be pushed away by someone who happened to be descending of Ali. Does it make sense? Yeah?
Not too much?
What I'm saying doesn't make sense?
Well, no, yes it does, but what they're saying doesn't make sense.
But they just, it was about power. They had a dynasty. I said, stay away from me. Is this how you write dynasty?
Yeah?
Okay, not an I? Okay, so that's it. They said, stay away. So you have a split. And the split was political. How? Because the Shiites, they tried to grab the power and they lost. Then what happened in the 16th century, only in the 16th century, one of the rulers of Iran adopted Shiism because he liked some of the rituals. Shiism has a few different rituals from the Sunnis. For example, they have the celebration of the day that Ali was murdered, the celebration of the day that his sons and grandsons were murdered. Have you all heard about them? Because they were all murdered. I don't want to go into it. It's such a bloody history. It is so bloody. This perfect time of good Muslims, it's so bloody, you won't believe. They all killed each other all the time. And so what happened was that there was this Shiite sect that had some different interpretations of Islam, and it was taken up by the Persian, then it was still Persia, dynasty, the Safavid dynasty. And that is why Iran became Shiite. And then the areas around Iran, you know, like parts of Iraq and so forth. Does that make sense? So then the big difference was who should rule the community, who may speak for God? Should it be people born from the house of the Prophet or can it be anybody? Yeah?
How do Muslims today reconcile the fact that Khadija was a very successful businesswoman? In fact, Muhammad was a sort of an employed buyer.
Yeah, well, it's kind of only Khadija and only Muhammad. Thing. Others don't do that.
They just ignore it?
Yeah, kind of, yeah. She's just like, you know, some saintly figure up there, kind of. But you don't really think about the details. Yeah.
How does the story of Muhammad rising up to heaven from the home of the rock?
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful story. Remember that yesterday we talked about how the Prophet Muhammad, by the end of his stay in Mecca, started to identify with the prophets from the Old Testament, especially Abraham and Moses, everybody who had had, you know, resistance. And one night, according to the tradition, he was taken up to heaven, no, first to Jerusalem, on a horse with wings, Burak. He was taken to Jerusalem, from where he went up to heaven. Today there is the Dome of the Rock. Have we all heard of the Dome of the Rock? Mm-hmm. According to the tradition, that was the spot where this happened. So can you see why the Dome of the Rock cannot go?
Right.
No way. Anyway, in heaven, he went up to the highest heaven and met with God. And it always hurts my feelings. Jesus was not in the highest heaven, according to this tradition. He was actually in the lowest heaven. He met with Jesus. He met with all the prophets, David, Abraham, and so forth. And the one with highest heaven, he met Moses, who led him to God. And there he talked to God. And according to the tradition, this is all tradition. It's not in the Quran. It's all tradition. According to the tradition, God said, this is going to be the purest and the best of my communities. And they will pray 500 times a day. He came out and the prophet and met Moses. And Moses said, are you crazy? You're going to have no followers. 500 times a day, then nobody's going to do that. Go back and renegotiate. Again. See, again, it's a very Arabic story. Have you ever been in a market negotiating? You know? Anyway, then he went back and became 50. And again, Moses said, too much. And that's how he became 5. There are only four prayers. Four prayers in the Quran. The fifth one is from that story. But God also said, this will be the best of my community. They will truly obey me. Wow, you can't win against that, can you? God himself said it. And then he went back and went back to Mecca and told the story to his followers, who then immediately felt, this is truly a prophet. And shortly after that, they went to Medina, but completely fortified by this happening. And the reason that they believe it's true is that he could describe the buildings in Jerusalem and allegedly never had been there. So that is the story. Okay. And it is in when this celebration takes place of the, they call it the Isra Mi'raj, the holy night journey. That is the only night, because when you go to the Muslim world in hotels and things, you can still get alcohol. Of course, there are sinful foreigners around and you want to make money off them, so you serve them alcohol, right? And it's the only night that you can get alcohol nowhere. Cairo, no, not a drop of alcohol anyway, because it is considered such a holy night, that night of the night journey. Yeah. So by the way, talk about alcohol. Do you all know the Marriott in Cairo? Who runs that? Who owns that? The Marriott in Cairo is a former palace. It's beautiful. It's fantastically beautiful. If you ever can go, you should. It is run by Mormons. And it has the most active gambling in all of the Middle East. And it's all sheikhs from the Gulf come and spend their money there.
Who did you say runs it?
Mormons.
The Marriott.
The Marriott in. Has any of you ever been in Cairo or in Egypt? You have?
I've not been there, though.
Yeah, if you go, you must visit the Marriott. It is a former palace. It's very pretty. Were you there?
Yes.
Have you seen it?
No, as a...
What?
As a poor tourist.
Right. But you probably didn't realize that, right? This is the hidden Mormon... what do you call it? How can I say it? mission to the Middle East.
Okay.
Yeah?
Can you put the Sufis in this context?
Okay, the Sufis, well, this is a very interesting question. When this system was built, the Sharia is law, right? What they built was a system of law, very much like the Jewish law. Very much, again, remember, early converts helping them, looked very much like the Jewish law. So what you get is a reaction. You get a reaction which very much, according to my interpretation, and now slowly some Muslim scholars are acknowledging that it happened, was inspired by Christian mystics, inspired by Christian hermits and monastics. There comes an anti-movement that says, no, it's not just law, it's in the heart. We can all have our own relationship with God. And that became the Sufis. the Sufi movement, the mystics. And the Sufis, they of course became a huge problem for the system. Because a Sufi who says, well, I just talked to God and he says this, what do you do with that, right? And Sufis who say, there were Sufis who said, I don't need to pray five times a day, I pray all day. You don't want that. So the Sufis, and that is where basically Abdul Wahhab, the Wahhabi founder, right, fought against Sufis. Because they are independent, they are all Protestants like we are, American Protestants, finding their own way to God. And that was not good for the system. You know, you wanted people to follow the rules. So they broke the rules very often. So that's where Sufism comes in. It's much mellower, milder, nicer, and so forth, and more personal. And suicide bombers don't like Sufis at all. No. So are there other questions? Or is this the sign that it is 1:45 that we should stop?
It's 5:02.
Oops, 5:02. Whoa, is it? Is it 5:02? Okay, there's one more question, but I don't know if we can hold it till Friday, or are you gone by Friday?
Yeah, I'm gone.
Oh.
Are the kids in Iran and other countries nearby really siding down with America in the schools? Are they saying down with America, America is bad? Do they recite this?
Well, I can imagine them reciting it. Yeah?
Every day.
I don't know if it's every day, but yeah, if you have certain schools, not every school, that could be part of the curriculum. Yeah, remember the madrasa? You have madrasas where you can do anything that you want. You get away with it. Because you are contained in your own place, often far away from the city.
Who would have decided they say this?
Some of the interpreters, some of the leaders, the mullahs or the sheikhs or the imams, or maybe the ruler of the school who is considered an imam by those kids. Yeah, and they have no frame of reference. They don't know what they're saying.
Yeah.
I've been called a kafir, a heathen, so often. I can't count anymore. Kids would come up and say, you are a heathen. I say, what do you mean? This is what I had learned. You're a kafir. A kafir, you know kafir? That's what they use, it's the word still used in South Africa. It's a Dutch word, kafir. A heathen. Yeah. But they learn it, but it has no context, you see?
Until they grow up.
Yeah, or maybe.